Welcome to the DJE Podcast, where you will learn about real estate investing from real life examples. Here's your host, Devin Elder.
Okay, welcome to the show. Today, I'm very glad to have with us Mr. Scott Choppin. Scott is a real estate developer of highly undersupplied multi-generational urban housing for families. He is producing investor opportunities in long-term hold new construction investments, which is a little different from what we normally talk about. And he focuses on high demand urban metros. Scott, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well. I appreciate the offer to join and happy to be here.
Yeah, great to have you on. So let's kind of kick it off. Where are you based out of and where do you live and do you operate there?
Sure. Yeah. Based in Southern California. I'm actually a native of the city of Long Beach where I live and raising my family, which is the fourth generation of our family and here in the city of Long Beach. We have worked all over the Western United States, although right now we're very focused in California, just given the demand characteristics for new construction in Southern California. We have plenty of, you know, work to do here and stay local.
Yeah, that's great. And that's nice.
Which we always love, you know, you'd always be in your backyard if you could.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. It's not always the case for everybody, but that's nice. So how, what was your journey like to kind of this investment space that you're at? How'd you get started?
So I actually have a family background in real estate development. So I'll differentiate for myself, our company and my family's background, predominantly development versus investment. Although, you know, they go together as everyone well knows. So I grew up around uncle and my dad who were in the business in various forms. And so it gave me a background on, you know, what does a real estate developer do? You know, why is that a good career choice? And most importantly, how can you, you know, make a career out of it and make money? So I actually spent from about the time I was 18, you know, numerous years basically going to school and working for companies to get training in what is ultimately a fairly complicated business. You know, zoning and construction and sort of the things that differentiate new construction from existing assets. So I've worked for, you know, major Fortune 500 companies. I work for a company that's now known as KB Home. It used to be Kaufman & Broad, and I work for a division of theirs that built multifamily new construction, basically apartment assets for their own corporate investments. And, you know, work for a couple other companies, but always in that vein of new construction, ground up, multifamily.
That's great. Yeah, I appreciate that. There seems to be kind of two separate camps, whether it's development ground up and you know, redevelopment guys like stuff we've historically done with my company and a lot of people we have on the podcast. So I'm excited to kind of dive in on some of the differences. Obviously, they're very different worlds. One of them, you know, B and C value add multifamily, you kind of have cash flow from day one and you're hoping to find something broken and come in and fix it and improve net operating income. Whereas on the new construction side, it's a different deal. A friend of mine that does development, we were having a conversation the other day and he said, I'm trying to have the conversation with all these value add people about new construction. It's the ultimate value add. We're taking dirt,
right?
We're turning it into, you know, this new stuff. So, you know, that kind of made sense. But maybe you can dive in a little bit on and educate our audience that might have some understanding of what kind of a B or C value add deal looks like and a reposition and cash flow and compare that with how do you talk to your investors on a, you know, ground up project?
Sure. And just by way of example, Joe Fairless in his book, he uses the term forced appreciation, right. And that's what development is. So your friend's exactly right. I mean, it's the most challenging, you know, high level forced appreciation, but you know, in essence, you're taking a raw piece of land and turning it into a brand new asset. So the way I like to think of it is really in three like buckets. So the first bucket is what everybody knows is how to underwrite apartments, how to, you know, find rent comparables, how to produce operating expense budgets and manage that so you can, you know, build NOI, increase NOI, right? So the normal sort of multifamily apartment underwriting. The second component is the development characteristics, which are zoning, construction, land acquisition, which we can talk about in more detail later. And then the third, which is ultimately what we're all after, is having an asset that's worth more than what you paid to produce it and selling it at some point, whether it be immediately in a merchant build model or hold it and rent it and then sell it for appreciation, you know, down the road. And that last characteristic is the same for you guys in value add as it is for us in new construction. You know, we're looking to produce value above our cost structure. So it's really in the middle, you know, the second bucket that is the most difference between value add and new construction. And that's where, as I talk to people like yourself, I say, hey, look, it's not insurmountable. The knowledge that's there needed to produce those new construction assets, it's not rocket science, right? Anybody could learn it, except it is more obscure. So, you know, most people who buy existing assets don't think too much about zoning, because guess what? It's already multifamily. You know, you've got a historical use. You don't care at some level that it's zoned X or Y or Z. You just know it's multifamily now, right? So those kind of questions just disappear for you when you buy an existing asset. And then, you know, in value add, you guys have construction challenges as well, except the challenge of construction is now more, because instead of doing paint, carpet, you know, cabinets, countertops, you try to avoid systems if you can. Sometimes you get into it in value add. And you guys, if you're doing it well, don't ever touch structural issues in an asset. You probably go away, right? So in new construction, we build all those systems, you know, foundations, framing, what we call MEP or mechanical, electrical, plumbing, all that's built new. So different, you know, set of subcontractors, more sophisticated construction people needed, both on the people who do the work and then those who of us who manage it. And then you're working with, you know, more sophisticated vendors, architects, civil engineers, etc. And so those, I think, would be the key differences, you know, sort of land acquisition, zoning in one, you know, category, and then sort of the build process. I guess I'd add a third, which is just the comfort level you have in your own underwriting and execution as a developer, because you brought up a key point. As you, let's say you have a 2-year build process on a significant, you know, institutional grade asset, new construction, you're going to have 2 years of money going out and no money coming in. In fact, you have to budget for the money going out and borrow it and raise it in equity. And so I think that when I talked about value add, you know, people who are looking to move into California can't find anything that makes sense from an economic standpoint because everything's too darn expensive. They start looking at new construction. And I actually, it's funny, I say, are you prepared to have 2 or 3 years of no cash flow coming in? And that usually stops about 80% of the people dead in their tracks, because, you know, it is a very fundamental difference. And some people just can't get comfortable with it. And I don't dispute that they're logic for themselves is appropriate. It's just, you know, one of the key differentiators.
Yeah, so much has to do with comfort level. You know, people say, I'm not comfortable with this. And it's like, well, lots of people are doing X. Mm-hmm. Just because you're not familiar with it doesn't mean it's not prudent. It's just, it's a comfort level thing. And
yeah,
a lot of people come up and under a certain, you know, they started investing with this one guy years ago and they did it mm-hmm. this way and that's the box. And I think there's a lot of validity to that, to stay with what you know and do what works. But
right,
clearly there's different approaches.
Yeah.
How are you guys approaching a capital stack on, let's say, well, first of all, let's paint the picture on what is a typical project? Is it 200 units that's going to go in kind of a B area, or am I way off base?
No. In the introduction, you talked about the multi-generational, you know, what I call workforce housing. So we have a track record of doing many different types of projects, anywhere from small to very large. About 3 years ago, we developed a 400 plus unit asset in Westminster, Colorado, that would be, you know, institutional grade, large, you know, institutional equity and debt. But in 2016, as we watched the market mature, we started to want to differentiate. So everybody was doing a certain type of urban housing, particularly where we are. And we've always been a company that wants to be, you know, making an uncommon offer, think contrarian, not being where everybody else is. So in 2017, we created a program called the UTH program, which is just our brand of a townhouse rental product, which is a three-story on-grade townhome, garage on the ground floor. But with a key differentiator is that we are building a five-bedroom, four-bath townhome rental product. So think of it like your standard townhouse model that most people would buy, right, in most traditional urban markets. Instead, we are building it to rent it to multi-generational families. And we've picked that space particularly because it's not well competed for. Nobody's really building in that space. And we see it, particularly where we are in California, as a vastly undersupplied market, high demand, low supply, which is the sort of characteristics that we want to see. Those projects, when we did the demonstration phase in the beginning, we actually purposely did small projects to prove the model. And so those were actually small as, you know, two duplex, fourplex, quads and that kind of thing, just to make sure that we could deliver the cost and rents and values for sale that we projected, which we did, and we've completed that. Now we've moved up into the production phase, which is projects that are in between 30 and 100 units. And particularly, we're limiting at 100 right now because when you build a five-bedroom, four-bath product and have families moving into these units, you have a different characteristic than your normal management of a, you know, standard one and two and three-bedroom, you know, multifamily product. So we're just being conscious about that, making sure that we're, you know, producing a good lifestyle for the families that live there. And, you know, particularly also for us in the infill environment, meaning in existing neighborhoods, it's hard to find, you know, 10 acres to build large projects. Those land assets are just less available generally.
That makes sense. So what is your capital structure and stack look like going in? Is it per project varies a lot, or is it you kind of have a repeatable model that you use?
We definitely have a repeatable model. In fact, you know, this UTH model is the most production-oriented design and build process we've ever had. In fact, I compare it to like a home building model. So, you know, in Texas, you'd have the Beezers and the Tolls and the KBs, you know, the Racos if you're in San Antonio, although I think Raco's gone now. We purposely want to build the same unit over and over again, because what that does, that drives cost efficiency. We can use the same subs over and over again. And in most markets, you guys are, I think, experiencing it, Texas, but in California, we've had very, you know, high increases in construction cost, both material and labor, as the markets return and we've up production. So we have to be very careful and manage that for simplicity. So our capital stack generally looks at, you know, pretty typical development model. It would be a 75-25. So 75% would be debt, construction debt in the beginning. 25% would be equity. That's a rule of thumb. There's no standard to that, but you know, most lenders are at, you know, somewhere between 65 to 75% loan to cost, right? And so we have to, you know, plug in the equity is the amount to make up the full capital stack. And we try to use the same lenders and investors, you know, deal after deal, because like you alluded to, if somebody's comfortable with an investment model and it's proven, of course, you know, that attracts, you know, returning capital as well as new investors.
Yeah, that makes sense. So really straightforward debt plus equity model, similar to what those of us in the value add multifamily space do.
Right.
Are you structuring, you know, I love these details on how people put deals together. And so are you structuring just kind of one equity set up for investors, or are there hurdles that you're hitting, or how do you guys like to set that up?
Well, so as far as the equity, you know, how we produce returns for equity, I mean, it is almost infinite. You know, we have some projects where it's a single high net worth investor or family office. But generally we're anywhere between, you know, if we can get 50-50 on the back end for a profit split after pref, we would always choose that. And we have some investors that will do that with us. I think the market for your standard investor in new construction, or even in your space, you know, might be 70-30, 80-20, you know, 80 to the investor and 20 to the sponsor. Sure. So we're really, in fact, you know, as we're prepping for this, you know, interview, you know, got me to think about, I mean, we really do compete amongst investors with people who are producing, like yourself, value add, projects, and we get compared all the time to that. And I mean, it's right. It's, you know, we're in a competitive market. And so, you know, it's our job as a developer and sponsor of these projects to produce both a compelling story about why these projects make sense, why somebody would make the move to new construction. You know, there's some, you know, story about our product in a defensible category in a recession that's, you know, probably, you know, out there fairly soon. But in many cases, because we ask people to take a higher level of risk, ostensibly while you have that 2 years of no cash flow and, you know, no building at all, going to an empty building, then to a full building and lease up and stabilization, we are having to pay generally a market superior return is how I describe it. You know, for development projects that would be, you know, low 20s and up on an IRR basis on a 2 to 3 year merchant build model. So in other words, merchant build is build it, rent it, and then sell it immediately as soon as you reach, you know, stabilized occupancy.
And is that the model for you guys to go with that merchant build exit, or are you ever looking at, hey, can we take out our investors, hit our IRR, and hang on to this thing for a decade?
So it's a great question. And actually, we find ourselves today in a changing situation with the economy. I mean, you're tracking it, I'm sure, as closely as we are. We're seeing the yield curve has inverted, you know, three month, 10-year inverted a while back, and we're now at the 2-year 10 inverting, at least, you know, playing with inversion. And so we're looking forward to 12 to 18 months out, some change in the market, downturn, recession, however you want to describe it. And so what that's had us do is basically leave the merchant build model. We're finishing. We have one project that'll start this month in Los Angeles, and we'll build that and sell it probably sometime, let's say early, let's see, it would be probably spring of next year. And then all the other or projects that come after that will all be long-term hold capital raises. So we're really looking for 5 to 10 year hold periods, same asset style, same UTH, same workforce, multi-gen. But now we say, look, if we raise 5-year money or 10-year money, we're bullish on the undersupply story. And when researching rents in the, you know, let's say Los Angeles market through 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, we really had almost no, you know, lowering of average rents across the market. In other words, very stable undersupplied rental market. And right now we're more undersupplied now in rental housing than we were back then. And so we look to the right kind of product being stable in a recessionary environment. And that's not, you know, your big projects that are renting to millennial and Gen Zs. I think those projects have pressure, meaning lowering rents, maybe oversupply. And so that was exactly why we shifted to this UTH model, was we want to be in a space that's undersupplied and vastly undersupplied if we can find it, right? Of course, anybody would do that if they could. Sure. And in this particular market, we see that. So we look to stable incomes during recession. And then in 5, 7, or 10 years, when the capital is ready to be paid back, either we sell the asset or, as you say, refi again, or maybe just raise new equity and, you know, pay out. We as a company, and me personally as the owner of the company, I want to hold assets long-term.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm in San Antonio. We've got certain market conditions here. Talk about Los Angeles. Thing comes to my mind. What's a cap rate on something you guys are in Los Angeles?
I mean, yeah, so great question.
I'm ready.
But you guys are going to laugh at this. We're hearing stories. I mean, again, we're not in the value add space per se, but I am hearing stories of people buying sub-4 regularly. Like that's the average. And then if you get into very, very tight markets like West Los Angeles, Santa Monica, and those kind of markets, even as low as 3, sub-3. And I've even heard a couple stories of, you know, somebody buying it at 2 cap, which, you know, I said, prove it to me, right? Show me. They couldn't. So I was like, it's not out of character when you're at a 4, sub-4, or a 3. Right. And, you know, I mean, maybe there's a story there for somebody as a buyer, particularly if they're a really long-term hold buyer, to say, hey, I have a great asset in Santa Monica. It's really hard to build there. There's a limit on supply story politically in California generally, and then some of these markets, that's almost impossible to build anything new. It's very, very difficult. So you could organize around that. But I also go, look, if you are wrong in the way rents are trending or the way the interest rates are trending, it's really easy to erase that 3%. I mean,
right.
Just in an instant, you could be upside down. Now, again, if you're long-term hold, maybe you go, fine, my value's below, you know, what it was when I purchased, but in 10 years or 15 years, it'll come back and maybe even exceed. And we certainly saw that in, you know, this, the recession, Southern California, although for sale housing was more, you know, critically hit than multifamily was. But you know, we had stable income, but lowering values. So we anticipate some version of that for multifamily. And so hence the preparation of long-term hold. We don't have to sell in 4 years when we're still in a recession coming out. We're 7-year money, 10-year money. And then we think we're going to be fine there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And cap rate's just one piece of the puzzle. It doesn't tell the whole story. It's just always interesting for me to hear these different markets, especially something that's so radically different than a Texas market.
Yeah, no 3-cap deals in San Antonio, probably.
Yeah, that's right. We might have bought some 3-cap based on actuals, but that's
right. But then you're delivering it at a 6 or 7 or 8 when you're done,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. We are seeing some compression though. It's interesting and kind of surprising too. So we'll underwrite for expansion. It's just, you know, nobody knows how.
But you guys are probably, you know, the term I use is vigilant, right? You know, in other words, we're still entrepreneurs in real estate. We want to produce prudent projects, but you have to be watchful and vigilant and, you know, prepare. And that's why, you know, have converted now to all long-term, you know, capital raises and no, you know, short-term, you know, money or a short-term deal, you know, project schedules.
Yeah. So what does a life cycle look like for you on a project where you've identified a piece of dirt and you're kind of kicking it off? Are you guys kind of sourcing these, the infill lots from brokers? Do you have somebody in-house sourcing it?
We do both. You know, as anybody, same as you guys in your market, you know, you're having every source that can possibly be found to try to deliver deals to your front doorstep. You know, we do have relationships with brokers, you know, from, you know, my institutional days, I've got a lot of those relationships. I will tell you though, that our UTH model really is better served to be in low and lower middle income neighborhoods. So think blue collar neighborhoods is sure. Where our tenant base is, and also where we like to develop because the challenges are less from any sort of political, you know, kickback or, you know, zoning or other, you know, moves we may need to make. But really, you know, two purposes for being in those neighborhoods. One is that's where our tenant base already is. They already live in these neighborhoods. We just happen to be giving them a 5-bedroom, 4-bath unit with a garage to live in, which is not a space other than the house that is available to rent in the apartment world. But also a key advantage is we're able to buy land more cost effectively, right? It's not as high demand. We're not competing with luxury, you know, for sale builders or even luxury multifamily guys. So what that does is it really takes a lot of the mainstream brokers out of play. They just don't, you know, track deals in those neighborhoods, and that's fine. But we do have, you know, key set of brokers that do travel in those areas. We have our own ongoing just weekly practices of our research, you know, CoStar and LoopNet and those kind of sources where we find stuff. And then interestingly enough, in California is a lot of cities are mandated to produce a certain amount of housing production under some rules that we have at the state level. And so cities have sort of become an advocate for us to try to produce housing in their own cities. And so they might call us and say, hey, I've got a piece of ground in city of Southgate and why don't you take a look at it and see if it makes sense for your program. And then a brand new one for us in California is school districts now are allowed to transact some school district land if it's to facilitate teacher housing. And our UTH model and teacher housing actually go together perfectly. Now it's very cutting edge, brand new. But I think in the long run in California, particularly if we're going to produce the amount of housing that we need to even remain remotely affordable, which we're not now, then every, you know, private sector employers, public sector employers, school districts, cities are all going to have to be producing, you know, as much velocity in transactions and new build housing as possible. And so, you know, normally cities are, you know, against development in many cases, or at least politically they are.
Yep.
Now we're starting to see with the force of new laws at the state level that cities are starting to go, okay, I guess I gotta begrudgingly get on board with this. And so we see those are as to, you know, long run, you know, future resources to produce more deals.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing for sure. And you're supplying a product that is absolutely undersupplied. So they should be getting on board.
Yeah.
Once you've you contract a piece of dirt, you're looking at kind of just for some perspective here for me, this is kind of unfamiliar territory. You contract a piece of dirt January 1. When's the first tenant moving in?
You know, we're generally underwriting for your average size project. So let's pick one now. We have a 53 unit project we're working on right now. So I give that about 14 to 16 months to build it.
Yep.
Okay. And then your absorption, you know, I might do 6 to 8 a month. So that plus, so just to line it up linearly. So we would, you know, get a piece of land under contract, right? Do our due diligence. That would be, you know, 45, 60 days. Let's say we're comfortable. We buy the land and then we start producing the plans. Plan production's probably 2 months. Plan check is probably 4, 6, 8 months. Then the build, 12 to 14 to 16 months, and then absorption. So you're really not getting into a tenant in your leasing operations for minimally 2 years, and in some cases 3 years on average. And that, you know, I think, you know, that's a key difference between, you know, in the value add space where, you know, you would turn units as you could. And that's really where that risk profile for investors differentiates itself, because they go, wow, I've got all these different new components. You know, I never had to do full architectural plans and civil right. and MEP. I never had to do plan check. Like, I'm speaking as if I'm the investor, you know, assessing that risk. And, you know, am I investing with a competent sponsor, operator, developer? Do they have a track record of doing that? And then unfamiliarity with those processes. So, you know, what I encourage investors to do is, you know, use their networks of people. Like, you have your friend who's a developer, and, you know, I'm sure you have these conversations with that person as well. And I also, you know, encourage people that either want to get into the real estate development business or investors that are looking at transition to, you know, partner up. We do joint ventures all the time with people that are, you know, like, let's say they want to come to California and they have no experience, although they're, you know, they're a developer from Florida. That is a real key differentiator in, you know, paring down the schedule, assessing and mitigating the risk correctly. You know, in California, the politics of rezoning and general plan amendments, what, you know, what I call entitlements, is a huge challenge and can sure. eat people alive, right, if you don't do it. In fact, that's why for UTH, we really predominantly buy zone sites, meaning by right. So we don't have any rezone or anything, that kind of thing. So, you know, in the beginning, I think I would always encourage, you know, people to joint venture or hire somebody or whatever. I mean, there's lots of knowledge of people that are in the real estate development space that, you know, can in essence be brought to the team in various different ways to make that transition more smooth.
That's such a great point. I always advocate that too on these larger projects, whether it's value add, new construction, et cetera. You know, you're talking about millions of dollars. There's nuanced components the whole way through. Mm-hmm. And joint ventures are great. You know,
yeah.
Figure out a way to add value and get in the game, and don't worry about necessarily your ownership stake when you're starting out. I think it's a great way to get started. And
well, it's, you know, in your space, it would be somebody who's, you know, raised equity and bought smaller value add assets, and they all of a sudden want to move into the, I want to buy 100 units, 150, 200, different set of investors, potentially different set of lenders, right? Different underwriting process. I mean, the technical characteristics of underwriting rent and operating expenses, NOI, are the same. Obviously the numbers are bigger, but I've seen many people that were moving into that bigger, you know, project space, which you always would do, right? As you become more sophisticated, you know, guys like right. yourself will get into bigger projects. You don't want to mess around with 20 units after you've been doing it long enough, unless it, right. you know, drops in your lap and it's, you know, cost zero or something like that. But I think it's the same thing in development. It's just finding somebody who has that skill set in that particular new domain that you can assess they really have that competence. And then sort of giving up piece of the deal. There is a cost to it, but what's the vice versa or the opposite, which is you lose the deal, right. You piss off investors, you lose money or you don't make money. I mean, nobody wants to do that. And, you know, certainly in the beginning of my career, we paired up regularly with, you know, people had more, you know, more liquidity, bigger financial statements for guarantees that you have to do on the construction loans, better knowledge. Maybe somebody has a site, right, that you covet and you go, wow, I'd love to develop on that site, but, you know, Joe or Jane, they control it. And so there's a story there about joint venture. And in fact, we still do it regularly, even as, you know, as seasoned and sophisticated as we are, you know, after 19 years of, you know, running this company, being, you know, purely in that space.
Right, right. So we've seen in our market, you know, a lot of the new stuff that's been developed in multifamily has kind of been this luxury. And it, so I guess that plays well for us as owners and sellers, and it's makes mm-hmm. it difficult as buyers because we're pretty supply constrained. But you've got a certain type of luxury product. What are you guys doing for a finish out on something that is workforce housing? I mean, you're not going top end on fixtures, but I'm curious to know what does that look like? And I don't know if you could quantify what you're saving versus a luxury product, but you know, maybe just kind of ballpark differences there.
I think you would find, like, if you looked at, you know, let's say your standard, you know, luxury product for a 20 something in, you know, Austin, right? Like we were talking about Austin before. I think you would find that the finishes that we supply are very similar. You know, we use a production grade cabinet. Recently we're doing quartz countertops and undermount sinks.
Nice.
You know, you can buy cabinets for very inexpensive that have self-closing mechanisms and European hinges. I mean, so that's the level. You know, appliances would be similar, you know, production grade, maybe a stainless insert if you can buy it effectively, carpet. You know, we try to do probably more, not hard surface like tile, but like a wood plank, like an engineered product or a vinyl plank product, because, you know, our units will be used, you know, harder, right?
Sure.
More kids, more family members, you know, for a 5-bedroom unit, we assume between 6 and 10 people. It's one of the reasons we do 4 bathrooms, because in, as you guys know, and owning multifamily assets over the long run, you know, your kitchens and your bathrooms just get beat, you know, to death, particularly bathrooms and plumbing and showers. So that's one of the reasons we went to a 4-bath, you know, setup, because we just knew that that would be, you know, utilized much more. On a cost differential, I would really think we're buying these products in a very similar cost category to your production, you know, luxury builders. I think the key differential in our cost savings comes in our building format. So earlier I mentioned a podium building. A podium building, you guys are familiar with it, would be parking structure below grade or on grade, and then the units sit on top of a, you know, concrete parking structure and, you know, go up, you know, 3, 4, 5 levels. It would be like a short high rise, it would be another way to describe it. And then our model is a 3-story on grade. So it's like your 2-story house, except it's got one level, you know, taller, but our garage is still on the ground floor, you know, entry door, foyer, you know, entry stairs. We do make them multi-generational by putting a bedroom bathroom on the ground floor. So if you had an in-law or, you know, grandma, grandpa, that kind of thing.
Sure.
So our big cost savings is in building a different type of building, meaning no podium, no parking structures, no complicated mechanical, electrical, plumbing, you know, really, really simple. Think, you know, in the old days, we call them, you know, dingbat apartments, right? It would be your most basic production. But we can buy cabinets, you know, like we source some of our stuff locally, or on occasion we'll buy them from overseas. But you can get cabinets very cost effective that look good and, you know, stand up reasonably well. And so, you know, our cost savings on finishes is probably de minimis compared to other, you know, luxury product. It's really in sourcing our land and more inexpensively. And then we have a less complicated, faster, simpler build. So that allows us to hire a different category of subcontractor where we can drive cost savings, right? You get into these big projects, you know, you don't have union labor, you know, you don't have a tower crane, you know, that you have in some of these bigger projects. So simplicity and reduction of complexity is really where I go. Anything I can do to make it simpler, you know, what the saying I have is complexity in development is the enemy of profits. The more complicated your project, and you guys have it same in value add. If you have a more complicated undertaking, that's why you would prefer never to do structural repairs on an apartment asset, because it's unknown, it's more complicated, you need a different higher level of subcontractors. So similar choices, different domains, right? But you're still looking to keep it simple, you know, keep it short and sweet on the execution, increase profits, increase velocity.
Love it. Love it. So we spend a lot of time talking to investors, and some are seasoned, some are new, and we kind of walk through the investment model. If you were talking to an investor and kind of walking him through investing in a project, what's the high level on, you know, I tend to think about things in terms of like a cash on cash return. Mm-hmm. If there's distributions, when do they start? Either IRR or average, you know, total annualized return over the life of the project.
Yeah.
Some of the conversations you guys have with investors for what you're doing.
Well, I mean, we're always, you know, I mean, it's always a comparison. I alluded to earlier, you know, not that we're talking necessarily the same people that you're talking to, but anybody who's relatively sophisticated investing in multifamily assets has an array of offers that they're looking at, and it's value add. I think we show up more often to people as something different. And so what we tend to do is we really tend to focus on the differentiators for new construction versus value add. Now, obviously we have these risk characteristics of, you know, a 2 or 3 year build process. We have to lease these up from zero, right? And we have to build it and acquire land. But on the flip side, you know, some of the advantages we see is one, when we do finish the asset and stabilize it, we have a brand new asset, like literally, you know, brand new HVAC, brand new systems, you know, all the things that, you know, when we own apartments that are older in the long run tend to break down over time.
Sure.
And, you know, so that's one key differentiator. The other thing that I look at, is when you buy an existing asset, you're always buying what is available in the marketplace. In other words, you can't go to a neighborhood and say, I really like that neighborhood, now let me produce an asset in it. Now, you would track the neighborhood, but still ultimately you can't force the property to come to sale. You either convince the seller to sell or owner to sell, or it's on the market, right? We now have this choice of going to a particular area or city or neighborhood and looking if we can find underutilized land or vacant land. Now we can produce an asset in that market that didn't exist before. So there's these unique ways to produce new opportunities that, you know, come out of thin air, all, you know, ostensibly. Sure. Right. Sure. And then the other one I really focus on is really a differentiator on the product type, what I call like the unit design. And so like for us, this 5-bedroom, 4-bath is a very key differentiator, right? We say, hey, that makes us different than everybody else. Really, we're on the extreme end of that spectrum, but there's high demand, low supply, right? One of the other things we talk about in our units is all of our units have a 2-car ground floor direct access garage, right? So it's like a townhouse, think of it, right? Think about any asset that you own. I own assets too. You know, I've lived in apartment assets. I never had a garage. That was my own 2-car garage that you could, you know, shut the world out and unload your groceries at your leisure. So those become key differentiators, both to attract renters at the rents that we want, right, which produce the returns. But also when I talk to investors, I highlight these key differences because I go in the long run, you still want to differentiate enough so that you don't have, I mean, the problem with owning any multifamily asset, like in Texas, you guys particularly have this experience in any market that's easier to build in, is you could buy an asset and then Trammell Crow could land next door and build, you know, 500 units of brand new housing. And yeah, that, you know, I mean, that's possible in California too, but in the neighborhoods and locations that we're in, generally not. And if anybody is, they're certainly not building 5-bedroom, 4-bath, right? So again, you know, uncommon offer, right? Differentiator, you know, what I call margin utility. In other words, what is different about our product that makes it different? Now, having said all that, I still have to basically convince investors that the risk mitigation and risk profile is worth the investment. And so generally, you know, we're going to be need to be at a higher cash on cash return, or at least equal on cash once we're stabilized. relative to, you know, other competitive offers in the value add space. And so, you know, generally for us, you look at a, you know, high teens, low 20s on a 5-year investment for an IRR. You know, an IRR is, you know, a good indicator, although, you know, it's very sensitive to how you underwrite, and particularly any underwriting is a function of how well are the projections that you make into the future. Sure. Am I trending rents? Am I trending operating expenses? Am I doing it appropriately? You know, we don't trend rents, but I know lots of people who are in new development that, you know, hey, I'm going to have, you know, 5% bumps for the next 3 years while under development. So my rents will be 15% higher when I get there.
You can make the argument. That's very interesting. I never considered that.
You can make the right. And I think, you know, anybody who's like relatively seasoned wouldn't do that if they could choose. In other words, if you could not trend and still produce good yields to investors and make your project feasible, you would always do that. So it gets into the slippery slope of, you know, particularly as markets heat up and construction costs go up, land becomes more expensive, you know, labor's harder to get. So timelines extend on construction schedules. That starts to be this pressure on returns. And it happens in the value add space too, right? As people compete, lots of capital competing for deals. You know, that's why you get into those 3-cap, you know, stabilized, you know, purchases in Santa Monica, because everybody's just beating each other up to try to get that deal because there's nothing else to buy, right? Or very, very little. So, you know, we're always looking to produce, you know, conservative underwriting, but an edge. And that's why we go to these, you know, different locations, different tenant profile, different construction type. And for us in the UTH model, we really like the story in a downturn scenario. Our tenants tend to be already from those neighborhoods, working class families. And the way I describe them is they're sticky. In other words, their social networks are strong. Their kids are in school, their church is down the road, their family lives all around them. More often than not, they're not long, you know, long distance commuters, right? They, you know, for us, like in Long Beach, you know, our typical tenant would be, you know, dad drives a truck at the port of Long Beach, right? Which is 3 miles away, and he doesn't need to get on the freeway and commute, right? So they tend to be very like localized, sticky. And you know, the joke I make is, you know, if you rent to millennials or Gen Z, and although it's perfectly logical for them in their life cycle, if they lose their job, they can move away very quickly. There's nothing keeping them local. You know, they don't have kids. They, you know, they don't have any, you know, networks other than maybe what they built to work. So my joke is, you know, that millennial renter can move to Austin yesterday.
Yeah.
Right. Like they, you know, they can scoot. And so not that we advantage ourselves related to our tenants being sticky. We just serve that family for the need that they have and just know that their lifestyle will be more stable for us in a downturn scenario. And then the last thing I'll mention is that, you know, there is a story for us to have some of our units, you know, small percentage units to be available to Section 8 families.
Sure.
And although we are not a, you know, we do have, I have an asset that I own in a Thousand Oaks. It's all Section 8, but it's seniors. Section 8's not for everybody, but we see a story there with Section 8 as being another stable source of renters. And for us, a very stable income source vis-a-vis the housing authority, you know, through HUD and the federal government on the Section 8 vouchers. So, you know, we offer those, you know, on a limited basis regularly, but in a downturn scenario, we had a hard time finding renters or our rents were under pressure. The Section 8 program is actually a good defensive place to go. And interestingly enough, because we do these 5-bedroom, 4-bath units, our rents in many cases are the market rents are the same as the Section 8 rents for that unit type or unit size, maybe a couple hundred above or below, but right there. Right. And so that, you know, that's a good story, you know, on top of that for a defensive, you know, stance in the units.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Scott, this has been really helpful to help me understand and hopefully some of our listeners understand the differences on the new construction side. I have one kind of personal, just curious question here.
Sure.
What's a dollar per square foot on something you guys are doing? I mean,
to build it
or $1.10 on rents.
Yeah. So great question. So, you know, we all focus on the value ratio. How much per square foot am I getting Interestingly enough, when we do these bigger units, we really don't focus on that so much. Where I basically focus is whole dollar rents.
Right.
And I do that because basically our units at a 5-bedroom, 4-bath might be $1,750 on average for our standard unit that we like to, you know, production build. And our markets vary anywhere from $3,000 a month to $3,500 a month. So that might be $1.70, $1.80, $1.90 a square foot, which, you know, in some markets would be high, but in California, like let's pick Long Beach, I mean, rents are easily $3.50 to $4 a foot as our, for your standard, let's say you got a studio or one bedroom.
Yep.
And, you know, we're looking at some projects that we're tracking where the 2-bedroom, you know, the rent's like, you know, $2,800 a month, and, you know, 3 blocks over, I have one of our UTH models, which is, you know, double the size, maybe more, and it's, you know, $3,250 a month.
Right.
Right. So comparably, now here's the thing, our families would never rent in that 2-bedroom. It's not an appropriate like form of unit, you know, 2 bedrooms, you know, 1 bath or 2 bath, right?
Right. Yeah.
Our competition really is houses. This is what I tell my people internally. If a family could have their choice, they'd always rent a house if they could. Right, backyard, detached garage, driveway, front yard, you know, American dream, white picket fence, except that the challenge is that either these owners of these homes, maybe an individual homeowner, maybe corporate owner, generally aren't going to rent to a family of 6 or 8 or 10. They wouldn't prefer that. So it's a little bit tougher to find. But more often than not, what ends up is those house rents are above where we're at. So let's say we're $3,250 in Long Beach or even $3,500 now. You know, either you can get a really old tiny house for $2,800 a month, right? But it's 2 bedrooms or 3-bedroom, 1 bath, no parking, no air conditioning, you know, nothing new, right? Or if you're going to get the bigger, newer house with systems, air conditioning, and driveway and that kind of stuff, you know, you might be $3,800, $4,000, $4,500 a month. And, you know, obviously most of those homeowners wouldn't ever accept Section 8, or it's much more difficult. So we're generally about $200 to $300 a month below the closest comparable house is sort of the metric we use. So when I give you these $3,250, $3,500, usually we've seen, you know, house rents that are $4,000 and above in comparison. So we're somewhere between $300 and maybe as much as $700 a month less. Now you don't get your backyard. You do have your 2-car garage. You know, the play areas are limited because obviously you don't have the front yard, backyard, but we're finding our tenants like recognize what the opportunity is, particularly because our projects usually are closer to what they already know, the job, the, you know, the community, family, that kind of thing. And so we're just trying to be coherent with an already existing market, right? Which is a family that lives in a blue collar neighborhood, is a working class family, would rent this or that if they could, but no one's offering it. And now we're just offering a new type of unit into a existing marketplace that never had that offer. I mean, there is almost nobody doing these 5-bedroom, 4-bath, and certainly nobody at scale. So we're, really, you know, compelling. Pretty differentiated.
It's a big unit, multi-generational. It's below what the house comparable to it is going to be. And it's brand new. I mean, what's the love, right?
Right. Exactly right.
Yep. Well, Scott, this has been really helpful. Thank you for adding a lot of value to our audience. If somebody wants to reach out, connect, get in your universe, learn more about what you do, what's the best route for that?
They can just go to our website, which is www.urbanpacific.com. And there's a contact page there, and certainly people can reach out through that. And that, you know, we'll go to our team and they'll get those folks in touch with me.
Perfect. Well, we'll link to it in the show notes. Scott, thanks so much for coming on. Take care.
Thanks, Devin. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the DJE Podcast. For more information, please go to djetexas.com.